Governor Kim Reynolds has raised the possibility of automatically restoring voting rights to felons in Iowa. It's a move that could affect more than 50,000 people in the state. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later in the hour, I'll talk with Iowa felons who have served their time and a representative from the ACLU of Iowa. Before that, the controversy surrounding LGBTQ policy at Iowa's 4-H youth organization. We'll hear from the ousted 4-H Iowa Youth Development Program leader and from a journalist at the Des Moines Register who investigated that firing. That's all coming up. First, a look at this hour's news.
Coming out, you know, and expressing themselves about what happened to them.
I really hope the Me Too movement is propelling us in that direction where assaulting people has consequences.
I think it's important that we listen to all of the women that are coming out and telling their stories and work on how we can engage them in a healing process.
The Me Too movement has led many people to share their experiences with sexual harassment and sexual assault. It has sparked conversations and controversy and maybe even change. I'm Charity Nebbe. Look for Unsettled, Mapping Me Too, a new podcast from Iowa Public Radio in the iTunes Store and on Google Play, or find it at iowapublicradio.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Recently, Governor Kim Reynolds raised the possibility of automatically restoring voting rights to felons in Iowa, a move that could affect more than 50,000 people in the state. Later in the hour, I'll talk with Iowa felons who have served their time about voting rights, also a representative from the Iowa ACLU. But first, let's talk about a controversial policy on LGBTQ members at Iowa's 4-H youth organization. Now, you may remember back in August, we found out that Iowa's then 4-H youth development program leader, John Paul Chasson Cardenas, was fired. He was the first Latino statewide youth leader in the 4-H's 115-year history. And his termination came months after a new suggested 4-H inclusion policy concerning LGBTQ people, guidance that has since been withdrawn. Now, that suggested inclusion policy drew ire from conservative groups and praise from LGBTQ advocates. The proposed policy would have allowed transgender 4-H members to use the bathrooms, the locker rooms, overnight accommodations that correspond to their gender identity, not necessarily their biological sex. Now, that was August. Fast forward to earlier this month. The Des Moines Register published details of their investigation into the firing. It found that the Trump administration pushed the National 4-H Youth Organization to withdraw a controversial policy welcoming LGBTQ members. It's a move that led to John Paul's firing, according to this investigation. Well, we'll talk with Courtney Crowder, one of the investigative reporters, a columnist actually with the Des Moines Register, to get more details in just a few minutes. But first, let's hear from John Paul Chasson Cardenas himself. He's joining us with his attorney, Roxanne Conlin. John Paul and Roxanne, welcome back to the program.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with you, John Paul. After that rather lengthy introduction, it is a rather involved controversy. Tell us, why do you think you got fired?
Well, I think the words at the time of my dismissal were pretty telling. At that time, I was told that my inclusion work was getting in the way of their extension work. And so to me, that's a red flag of why I was being dismissed. It's also before that, I had gotten a letter of correction that talked about the proposal that I had made. And it was a proposal. It wasn't full policy. It was just starting that process of going through the policymaking procedure. And it talked about me proposing this was unprofessional. And so that's kind of the hints that I had around it.
Mm-hmm. And where did this idea for sort of enlarging the LGBTQ community come from? What is the national push that you were reacting to here in Iowa?
A couple of different things are happening. One is that 4-H had been dying in many ways, had been losing population over the last 20 years, including in Iowa. We've seen a massive decrease in loss of kids. And so when I came into office, one of the reasons that I got asked to start this job is because there was a national push for inclusion in the 4-H organization. When I say the 4-H organization, I'm talking about committees that are governed by or including of state leaders from all over the United States. And so we began to move forward in trying to make 4-H the most inclusive organization and to be known as much for our inclusion as for our work in rural communities.
Mm-hmm. Is it fair to say that was a push from the Obama era?
It is fair to say this, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we had a change in administrations, and then you went ahead with the policy, the proposal that was then still at a national level, or was it withdrawn?
It was withdrawn after we had made the proposal in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. What was lacking at 4-H here in Iowa that you think this guidance, this proposal, would have remedied specifically?
I think the best way to talk about that is actually to read a quote of one of the young people who actually talked about when we made that proposal. And I'm just going to read this young person's words. "I just want to say thank you. Last year, I was humiliated and kicked out of 4-H by one of my volunteers for being gay. My parents went to the director in the county extension office who shouted at them for not raising a normal, in quotes, kid, and I should suck it up and get over it. I had promised to never come back to 4-H. But if this policy passes, I will join my senior year. Thank you." And so that's one of the pieces of feedback we got back when we asked for public input.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about how the Iowa Constitution fits in with your thinking here.
Well, in Iowa civil rights, it's one of the bedrocks of this. We were just, when we took the policy and guidance, because there's three parts to the document that we released. One was the policy section. It was simply a restating of federal, state, and university policy. So it's just restating that. So to me, that was not controversial. It's something that was already there. The second part was a list of definitions. And the third part was the guidance. How are you going to be able to implement the laws that are already there? Something that I was charged with as the 4-H leader to be able to sort out and move forward.
I want to read a comment from Iowa State University. In seeking comment from Iowa 4-H, we spoke with John McCarroll of ISU Media Relations, who said that John Lawrence, vice president of Iowa State University's Extension and Outreach, which oversees Iowa's 4-H program, is preferring not to do interviews about this story at this time. But anyway, asking for details explaining your dismissal, Iowa State issued a statement listing, in ISU's words, quote, "your tendency to focus on individual tactical projects while neglecting the overall strategic direction of the Iowa 4-H program, concerns raised by peers, employees, and partners about his management style and pattern of poor decision-making and judgment," end quote, from ISU. Lawrence said his message to extension staff across Iowa after your termination was that despite a change in leadership, in his words, "we've not had a change in direction. Our focus on diversity needs to continue, and quite frankly, we need to strengthen it," end quote, from Lawrence. Can you understand his position in those words?
I really cannot, and it's been confusing to me. I have heard a lot of nice words said, but when the rubber meets the road, I just haven't seen the policies that reflect that. Even in the way that I was terminated, so I was called into a meeting without previous notice. I was given one set of why I was being terminated. My letter had a different statement on it, which simply said, you're at will and we're going to let you go. The statement that you read was not released until after the Des Moines Register picked up the story. Mm-hmm. And so what is being stated in that quote was never told to me at any point. Not only that, but in just that March, you know, right before this whole incident, I had received, and I've always received, meets or exceeds expectation reviews. And John Lawrence and Chad Higgins had nominated me for national awards, and we had gotten several national award recognitions for our work. The final thing that is intriguing about all of this is that, to me, it did not become an issue. My professionalism did not become an issue until there was a pushback by a national hate group. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't resonate.
Which group was that you want to point to?
I believe it's called World News Daily or World Daily News, and it's listed by the Southern Poverty Law Center as in their hate groups.
Back to the simple question of when you were told to take down this policy suggestion, however you want to term it, why didn't you just comply?
It felt dishonest to me. We had an established process that the policy was going through. So this was a proposal. It went through a public hearing. Then it would go back to committee, and we would review it and do the final application, which John Lawrence had the ability to sign and legal counsel had the ability to look through. Where I really did not... where I felt that we had gone too far is when I received the communication saying not only that we had to, that John Lawrence had taken it up, he was taking up the issue, but completely took away all program policy from 4-H. So he changed the process in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. And then I had some strong feelings, and there were my strong feelings, but they were based on research and talking with people and meeting with experts from all over the United States around two things. One was that in the policy that is there right now really comes from a disability frame, comes from a place that says, one, kids need to disclose that they're LGBTQ and that is a disability, it's less than. To me, that frame itself was problematic, and so that was one. The second one is that I did not feel that anything, and to this point that I've never said that the content of the policy or their guidance is incorrect. That's never been there. And so we did a lot of research and work to be able to do it. We were echoing a national policy that was already written. We were echoing what's been done by school districts all across our state and by the Civil Rights Commission and Department of Education in Iowa. So there's nothing really new in there. And so I did not understand why the discomfort by some people. And here's another quote, just to give you an idea of what was coming at me at that point, was, open the door for rapists and pedophiles, truth biology, homosexuality is a psychosexual malady which prevents natural inclinations. If I have a male pig, can I enter it into the breeding? That's the kind of feeling that transgender's condition is child abuse. Those are the kinds of things that we were getting back. Mm-hmm. So the argument is, the argument for me of saying no was really entrenched in the research, and that I was hearing from 4-H'ers, my staff, volunteers, that we have had incidents where LGBTQ youth are not made to feel welcome. Okay. And my approach was to make it universal, that mm-hmm. all the work that kids should belong is a universal construct. And so that's where we were going.
Okay, we don't have much time, but I want to ask you, and perhaps your attorney Roxanne Conlon would like to jump in here. What's next? What is the what do you see? How is this developing? And what will you be doing?
We have filed a complaint with the Iowa Civil Rights Commission, and it's going through that process. And I fully expect that we will remove the case to district court, because under Iowa civil rights law, there is no question whatsoever but that discriminating on the basis of transgender orientation is illegal. So Iowa State is in the state of Iowa. It is the state of Iowa, and for it to discriminate on that basis is abhorrent to me.
Okay. Attorney Roxanne Conlon and John Paul Chasson Cardenas, thank you for this conversation. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. If you've just joined us this first half hour talking about the firing in August of the 4-H Iowa Youth Development Program leader, you just heard him there in that conversation with John Paul and his attorney Roxanne Conlon. Also, how that firing ties in with the controversy surrounding LGBTQ policy at Iowa's 4-H youth organization. Joining me now, Courtney Crowder, Iowa columnist with the Des Moines Register. She and Jason Clayworth, investigative reporter at the Des Moines Register, led this investigation. Welcome to the program, Courtney.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let me read just the headline from your exclusive earlier this month. I believe it came out, published on November 18th, How Trump Administration Pressure to Dump 4-H's LGBT Policy Led to Iowa Leaders Firing. The Trump administration pushed the National 4-H Youth Organization to withdraw a controversial policy welcoming LGBT members, a move that helped lead to the ouster of Iowa's top 4-H leader earlier this year. That's the findings of your investigation. Connect the dots for us, Courtney.
Sure. We were able to speak with Dr. Sunny Ramaswamy, who was the director of the NIFA organization, part of the USDA. And sorry, it's going to get a little alphabet soupy here when we talk about 4-H. He is basically the guy who was in charge of all 4-H programs across the country. And he was called into a meeting by the chief of staff for Sunny Perdue, the director of the Department of Agriculture, and told to remove the policy. The chief of staff to the director of agriculture, responds to the director of agriculture, who responds to the president. And frankly, the removal of the LGBTQ policy fits into many, many things the Trump administration has done since taking office to discriminate, or at least to remove rights that transgender people had under the previous administration.
Right. In viewing them, the Obama administration made it more inclusive. And here, what to put it simply, the Trump administration saying you are either male or female.
Right. Yes, you're a male or female determined by your genitals at birth. That mm-hmm. is the Trump administration definition.
Okay. So how did that filter down into the Iowa 4-H?
So this policy had already been sent out to the entire international 4-H organization by the time this meeting with Ramaswamy and the chief of staff of the Department of Agriculture occurred. So all of the statewide leaders had received this policy as part of a multi-year diversity effort. So it wasn't just LGBTQ welcoming policies. It was welcoming policies for Hispanic children, for children with disabilities, for incarcerated children. Mm. John Paul received this policy, he posted it, and in the intervening time after he had posted it, the national group took it down. And so now you have a situation where oftentimes conservative Christians are fighting back against a policy and saying, the national group doesn't even believe this anymore. And so you have Iowa State really sort of in a rock and a hard place, saying the Trump administration, you know, my commander, if you follow it all the way up, has pulled this down. But in Iowa here, we support gender identity as a protected class. What to do? And John Paul stood strong and he said, I'm going to fight xenophobia within the ranks here. And I'm going to keep this policy going. And frankly, our reporting shows that is what ultimately led to his firing.
Mm-hmm. So Iowa, in this case, was an outlier in keeping that. How did other states react in comparison?
Other states pulled it down. I don't know if Iowa is the only state. We spoke to people in eight different states. Other states pulled that policy down. Other states leaned on their state policy as far as protected classes. Other states sort of made it go away. Nobody, to our reporting, has stood up in the way John Paul stood up.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, so 4-H, this idea that 4-H needs this inclusive policy to survive, that it's dying, I think John Paul said there. Is that backed up by the facts?
Yeah, it is in general. 4-H, and this is John Paul's quote, but I'll use it anyway. Tradition is 4-H's greatest resource, and tradition is also 4-H's biggest problem. People, as you well know, in Iowa especially, have been members of 4-H going back generations. And as such, they expect it to be the same. But as we all know, the world is changing. Demographics are changing. Social opinions are changing. And 4-H, as an organization, if it needed to continue, it needed to grow and it needed to diversify. And there's been some pushback on a number of fronts for people who are saying, you know, this is not the 4-H I grew up with. And the answer is it won't be. If we want it to grow, if we want to nurture 4-H, it cannot be the 4-H that you grew up with. But it can have that same heart. You know, at its core, it's a leadership organization. It's about helping students find their voice. And that has never changed.
We have a couple callers, but because of the lack of time, I'm going to put their questions to you. And if you could briefly answer, Courtney, because we are running out of time.
Sure.
Could LGBTQ members be barred from 4-H to begin with? Is that illegal? Brad in Marshalltown asks.
Sure. So, Ben, as with this story, it's yes, no, and maybe. In Iowa, gender identity is a protected class. You cannot bar people because of their transgender status. Federally, it's not a protective class. So where does 4-H fall? As an organization that's supported federally and locally, who does this fall to as far as who's protected? And I think we'll see that play out in the courts here.
Mm-hmm. Troy in Iowa City asks, isn't ISU legally able to fire him for anything?
That's what his original letter said. You know, you serve at will of John Lawrence, and I'm pulling my will. So, yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
but
that's
it has
what
to,
his...
it has to abide by the Iowa Constitution.
Right. And that's what they will argue in court, is that the real reason for his firing was not just because they got tired of him, which is what his letter says. It is for this policy.
Okay. So, Courtney, what will you be following up with in this investigation? I assume with Jason Clayworth.
Yeah, we are looking into some issues of racial bias in 4-H as well. And we'll just keep tabs on this. I mean, I think if Roxanne Conlin is being truthful and saying that she wants to fight this in court, this will be an interesting case as far as determining where 4-H lands. Is it a local issue? Is it a state issue? Is it a federal issue? But we have come across some documents in regards to racial disparities that we're looking into now. And of course, I'd love to hear from anybody who's been discriminated against in mm-hmm. that way.
Mm-hmm. I want to say that you can follow Courtney's reporting on Twitter at Courtney Care or Jason Clayworth at Jason Clayworth. So quickly, reactions to this investigation that came out a few days ago.
Yeah, they've been mixed. Here's the thing. Oftentimes, and I love my Christian and conservative friends, but that's where this is coming from. That's where sort of the vitriol is coming from. And oftentimes, they are whipping up an image of a trans person as a nefarious man who conceives of some kind of malicious plot to get his hands on girls. He's going to put on a wig and go into a bathroom and carry out something evil. And as I say that, I hope people can understand how crazy that is. Transgender people are people just like all of us. And in the case of 4-H, we're talking about transgender kids. Kids who oftentimes, from the moment of birth, have said, I am not a boy, I'm a girl, mm-hmm. and have lived their life that way. So we've heard from all different sides, but that's what I want people to know.
Courtney Crowder, thank you so much to you and also, of course, your partner there, Jason Clayworth at the Des Moines Register. Courtney Crowder, Iowa columnist with the Des Moines Register. Once again, you can follow her reporting at Courtney Care on Twitter. Thanks, Courtney.
Thank you so much.
Coming up in just a moment, We'll talk about how Governor Kim Reynolds has floated the possibility of automatically restoring voting rights to felons in Iowa. We'll talk to a couple of felons who've served their time after a short break. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in a moment. So glad you could join us midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, recently, after being asked what she thought of the state of Florida restoring voting rights to an estimated 1.5 million felons in that state, Governor Kim Reynolds signaled that Iowa might be looking to do the same. She said her administration is looking at several criminal justice reforms and that restoring the right to vote for Iowa's more than 50,000 felons might be one of them. Well, let's discuss this with a couple of the people impacted by the change in just a moment. But first of all, Daniel Zeno is with us, policy director for the ACLU of Iowa in our Des Moines studio. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
React to the governor floating this idea. Surprise?
So, you know, we are happy that the governor is interested in addressing this very serious issue in Iowa. Iowa has been a leader on a whole range of civil rights issues. This is one where Iowa is way at the back of the line. Iowa and Kentucky are the only two states in the country where if a person is convicted of any felony, they automatically lose their right to vote. And so we're happy that the governor and the legislature is interested in addressing this problem.
Mm-hmm. How do you see that strictly through a civil rights lens? Why isn't it not okay with the present policy in Iowa and Kentucky or whatever other states you mentioned for people to have to apply to get their right to vote back? Why isn't that okay?
So, you know, the right to vote is really the right to participate in democracy, the right to be a member of your community, to have a say in what happens to you and your family and your community. When a person commits a crime, they're convicted, there are consequences, right? After the person has done the thing we collectively have said they should do, go to prison, pay fines, whatever we've said they need to do, once they've done that, that person should be able to rejoin the community. In fact, it helps the community. It helps the person. And so we think automatic restoration is the way to go. That's where most states have some version of automatic restoration for some convictions. And we think Iowa should join the vast majority of the states and do that right here in the state of Iowa.
Mm-hmm. And it used to be that way in Iowa until when?
So in 2005, then-Governor Vilsack issued an executive order that automatically restored rights, voting rights for people convicted of felony. And that stayed in place until 2011, when then-Governor Branstad rescinded that order. So from 2005 to 2011, there was automatic restoration of voting rights in Iowa. That was done through an executive order. You know, Governor Reynolds right now could issue a new executive order that would change the situation, but it's not a long-term solution because it really, whatever governor's in office could change that. And so that's why we think there should be legislation and then in the long term change the Iowa Constitution.
Daniel Zeno is with us, policy director for the ACLU of Iowa, reaching out to our listeners this half hour. Have you served time for a felony? Are you able to vote? Is it important to you that your voting rights be restored? Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Joining us by phone, Jay Hughes. Jay Hughes, welcome to the program. Jay Hughes, are you there? Okay. Justin McCarthy. Let me try Justin McCarthy. No Justin McCarthy either. We'll continue our conversation with Daniel until we get... Well, it sounds
hello?
Like... Is this Jay Hughes?
No, this is Justin.
Justin, thank you for joining us. We'll take you, since you're available there, calling in. Tell us a little bit about your background. This is a change that would impact you?
Not so much anymore. I used to live in Iowa and moved over to Illinois, so now I've actually gotten my voting rights back.
Mm-hmm. But tell us a little bit about your conviction.
I was convicted in 2006 of a user of controlled substance in possession of a firearm, so I got arrested for having weed and a gun in the same house. Did 15 months in federal prison, another 3 years of parole, and got done with my sentence in 2011.
Did you move out of the state partially or wholly because you couldn't vote?
That was a good part of it. I just got really tired of not having a say in where my tax money was going, so I figured I'd go to another state, and all I had to do was live there for a year and got my voting card.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of this idea by the governor possibly restoring voting rights automatically here in Iowa, as other states do as well?
I really think that's the way to go. I mean, once you pay your debt to society, it's all paid. I should be able to do whatever a normal citizen would be able to do. I don't see why, you know, felons in Iowa have to continue to be perpetually punished for something that they did, you know, maybe 20, 30 years ago in their past.
Mm-hmm. What would you say if you could testify before the legislature, before the governor? What plea would you make on behalf of people in your situation?
I mean, just give us what we work to get back. You know, I mean, there's a lot of guys who go out there, they do their time, they come out, do their parole, their probation, and there's really no carrot at the end of the stick for them. It's, you know, you do what you need to do, you pay into society, but you don't get a say in it. And I really think that, you know, people in my situation, if we did know that at the end of the road, we do get a say, we do get to feel more like a human being again, there wouldn't be possibly so much as of a recidivism rate.
Justin,
I think there's a lot of people that are just really frustrated.
Mm-hmm. Justin, when you did live in Iowa, did you start on the process, pursue that at all, the process of having your voting rights returned through the process in place?
I was actually in the process of getting all the paperwork around for it when my wife and I decided to just jump ship and move over to Illinois.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Justin, I wonder if you think we just had our midterm election, of course, and we had a huge voter turnout. Even though we say huge, it was not even half of the voting eligible population that cast a ballot in these midterm elections. Do you see that as an irony? You're going to great lengths to regain your right to vote.
Yeah, I mean, I was ecstatic to go into my voting, you know, my polling place and actually get to vote for the first time since I was 18. So, I mean, I think you might get a little bit more of a turnout for people to come to the polling places. You know, at least 50,000 more people have an opportunity to go.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'd get a lot more people involved in the political process and might be able to affect some long-term change for a lot of people.
Okay, Justin. Justin McCarthy, thank you very much. Served his time, wants his right to vote back, has it now in Illinois, moved out of the state in part to get that right to vote back. Justin, thank you for sharing your view.
Thank you.
Daniel Zeno still with us from the ACLU, policy director at the ACLU of Iowa there. So, Daniel, how many such testimonials have you heard like Justin's?
You know, we have heard lots of anecdotal stories of people who say, you know, I just want to be part of my community. I want to be able to decide who's on the school board and who's my local mayor and who's my local city council person so that I can feel like I'm part of this community. And like Justin said, you know, people have paid their debt to society. They've done the thing we collectively have said they need to do. I do want to make one point. I think it's an important point. So in Iowa, any person convicted of any felony loses their right to vote. And in Iowa, that ranges from, for example, damaging property worth $1,000 or more. So let's imagine a 22-year-old who does a stupid thing and damages a RAGBRAI bike that's worth $1,500.
Mm-hmm.
That could be a felony conviction and automatic loss of your right to vote for the rest of your life, right? And so, this is a really important issue that impacts, like Justin said, over 50,000 Iowans who are in Iowa, living in Iowa right now, participating, paying taxes, raising their family, who can't participate. And we think they should be able to participate.
Mm-hmm. In other states where the voting rights are automatically returned once the felon has served time, do all crimes, all felons automatically get their right to vote back, or are there some felony charges, convictions that don't allow that?
So it varies across the states. For example, in Florida, they just passed the ballot initiative this past November that restored voting rights for about 1.5 million people. So in the state of Florida, if you are convicted of any crime that is not murder or sex offense, then you automatically get your right to vote back. But if you are convicted of murder or a sex offense, you don't get your right to vote. So there are some states that have determined, you know, some particular kinds of crimes you don't get the right to vote back. What we've proposed, ACLU in coalition with lots of others, is at least one option is to think about violent felonies versus nonviolent felonies. That's one line that could be drawn where you say if you're convicted of a nonviolent felony, for example, possession of drugs, then you automatically get your right to vote back once you finish your sentence. But if you commit a violent felony, then you have to go through a process.
Would that destruction of a RAGBRAI bike, that very expensive RAGBRAI bike, be a violent felony?
It would depend on the situation. The situation I was describing would be criminal mischief, which probably it's a Class D felony, so the lowest level felony in Iowa. Mm-hmm. So there's a way to kind of, you know, divvy up what felonies are violent and which ones are not. But we are ecstatic that the governor and the legislature are interested in thinking through this issue and trying to figure out how does Iowa, like Iowa has done in a whole range of other issues, get to be a leader on this issue and not be in the back of the line.
Daniel Zeno is with us from the ACLU of Iowa, talking about the restoration of voting rights to felons who have served time. Let's go quickly to the phones. Will is in Iowa City. Hi, Will. Welcome to the program.
How's it going?
Real well. What's your story?
Well, I had a felony conviction in 2012, and my voting rights weren't interrupted until 2017, when I received a letter that said that I wasn't going to be able to vote anymore because of my felony conviction. So I got some paperwork to get my voting rights restored, and I'm going through that process now.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, just have to prove that I paid off all my fines and I did everything that I was supposed to do, and I haven't done anything since.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, when someone applies like this, what are the chances they will get the voting rights returned?
So, you know, it's hard for us to know. We know, according to the Des Moines Register, the governor has said 88 people's voting rights have been restored. We don't know how many people applied. We believe most of the people that apply do get their right to vote back. But we got to also put it in perspective, 88 people out of over 50,000, at least to us, means there probably is something about the application process that results in only 88 people applying, as opposed to all 50,000 or so people who could apply, who aren't applying for some reason.
Mm-hmm. Back to you, Will, in Iowa City. Why is this so important to you when so many Americans, just of their own free will, don't bother to vote?
Oh, I think that everybody has to. Otherwise, we find ourselves in the situation that we currently are in.
Will, in Iowa City, thanks for calling.
Yeah, have a good day.
You too. Jim is in southeast Iowa. Jim, what's your story on this topic?
1969, breaking and entering, possession of burglary tools. When I was discharged from parole, Governor Ray restored my citizenship. Governor Ray's chief of staff, when I applied for a pardon, said that I was a great candidate for a pardon. The only problem I had, that I had applied too soon. In 32 years later, when I was let go from a position, a very public position, the only excuse that they could come up with was, after all, I was a felon, you know. I've been denied participation in a professional profession, which I went to school and obtained a graduate degree to perform. I couldn't be a watchmaker. I was denied public employment with the city of Des Moines in the early 70s because of my felony conviction, even though I qualified for the position. And if you want to know why it was important for me to vote, is that once you can't vote and you see everybody else going through the polls, you want to do what everybody else is doing and be a part of your society. And to have a say in who's overseeing the instruction of your children in public schools, who's overseeing the provision of medical services at the county hospital, who is overseeing the administration of justice in our state, We have a judicial appointment system whereby several names are presented to the governor, and the governor appoints, but there's a retention election after that to have a vote in that. When Mr. Hubble had a chance to talk to him while he was running for governor, he agreed with me that if you're not in custody or under supervision, that you should have the right to vote. And whether you paid your fines off or paid all of your restitution, which in some cases will never be paid because most people are with felony convictions are working at minimum wage jobs or not much better.
Okay, Jim, we're going to have to edit. We got the point loud and clear from you, Jim, in Southeast Iowa. Another testimonial there, Daniel. Do we expect the legislature to be on board with this suggestion by the governor?
You know, I lobby on behalf of the ACLU, and so you know I'm going to be talking to as many legislators as I can. The ACLU is a nonpartisan organization, and so our position has nothing to do with who people will vote for. Our position is about making sure as many of us can participate in the process. And so we're interested in talking to Republicans and Democrats and whoever is interested in addressing this important issue. And so we're going to be, we have been and we'll continue to be talking to legislators, talking to the governor's office to try to get the very best legislation that we can get past this session.
Other criminal justice reforms possibly changing in the future? Do you see any likelihood of that? What would they be?
So, you know, we work on a whole range of other criminal justice issues, including trying to end mass incarceration, you know, reducing racial disparities in the criminal justice system. In fact, on this issue of voting rights for people with felony convictions, we know that there's a disproportionate impact on African Americans because they're arrested at a higher rate, charged with, you know, more harshly, go to prison more for longer. And so those kinds of issues. And then, you know, the issue of marijuana has been in the news and in the legislature a lot lately. Last session, Senator Zaughan introduced a bill that would reduce the penalty for first-time possession of marijuana, which we think is a good direction to go into. And so, we're working on a whole range of criminal justice issues, and we'll continue to do that.
Mm-hmm. Does immigration fit into that as well?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, last session, the legislature passed and the governor signed Senate File 481. That is the law in Iowa right now. You know, we expect this coming session there will be some immigration-related bills. In fact, we had a meeting this morning with a range of immigration-related organizations to think through, you know, what do we do? What are we expecting? And so immigration is absolutely going to be a topic that we'll be monitoring in this upcoming session.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit more in the time we have about the racial justice component here and how Iowa lines up or compares with other states, not very favorably.
Right, right. You know, so Iowa has the sort of unenviable position of having about 3.5% black population and about 25% of the prison population are African American. So there's a pretty big disparity in who's in prison in Iowa. We know African Americans are about 8 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession or drug possession. And so there are some real racial disparities that we think, you know, the state of Iowa can and should address this issue. Like I said earlier, Iowa has been a leader on a whole range of issues. Marriage for same-sex couples, you know, desegregating schools. Iowa's been a real leader. This is one of those issues where Iowa's in the back of the pack. And we think that this is a prime time for the state legislature to, for example, pass a bill banning racial profiling by the police. That's one bill we've been working on with the NAACP and others. And so that would be a first step to begin to address some of these very real issues.
Mm-hmm. Daniel Zeno, wrapping up the hour with the policy director for the ACLU of Iowa. Let's squeeze in one more call. Joe is with us from Marion. I have to ask you to make it quick, Joe, but we sure are glad you called in. Welcome.
Real quick then, Ben. Simple solution to this problem, let's not take away voting rights unless the violation of the law was a voting-related violation. Somebody commits voter fraud, then it makes sense. Otherwise, wouldn't we want to encourage civic participation, you know, reduce recidivism, you know, the whole bit?
There's an interesting idea, Joe, in Marion, if I'm interpreting that correctly, even while you're serving your sentence, Daniel, do any states do that?
So there actually are, I believe it's two states. Maine is one of them. I believe it's Vermont. It's one of the states in the Northeast where you actually retain your right to vote while you're incarcerated, whether it's a felony or a misdemeanor, no matter what crime it is. So that does exist. And I think Joe brings up another option, right, of how do you draw that line? Mm-hmm. You know, Joe's suggestion is the line is it related to voting? If it's not, then you should get your right to vote. So I think there are lots of options the legislature could consider. But at the very least, I think, you know, like I said, we're happy that the governor and the legislature are interested in addressing this issue. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. Throughout our whole history here in the U.S., we've had this tug in terms of justice, criminal justice between, you know, rehabilitation and punishment, right? And it's mm-hmm. reflected right here as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, this is one of those where people complete their sentence. They're back in their communities. They're paying taxes. And then the question becomes, do we want those people to really be reintegrated in the community? Mm-hmm. Voting is a very important part of that. Being able to participate, like the caller from Southeast Iowa was talking about, being able to pick your school board member.
Right. Daniel, before we say goodbye, can you tell us where those interested might find out more information about this?
So you can go to the ACLU of Iowa website, www.aclu-ia.org.
Okay. Thank you very much, Daniel Zeno, Policy Director for the ACLU of Iowa in our Des Moines studio. Thanks, Daniel. And River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Hey, it's already Tuesday. That means tomorrow it's already Wednesday. Politics Day tomorrow. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University will be joining us as one of our two analysts. Plenty to talk about. Politics at home and abroad. We hope you'll join us. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.